Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is the advanced technology track, so hopefully everyone's in the right place. We've got a couple of talks before lunch. We're running about 20 minutes late, which means we're going to be probably breaking for lunch about 1 o'clock. Just wait till the last people finish clearing cups and people sit down. So our first of the two talks today is by David Cornwall, and we'll get going.
Good morning. Thank you for coming to my talk today, which is entitled Quantum Computing and Its Impact. This is an outline of the talk. To begin with, I'll be providing an introduction to quantum computing. I'll discuss the physical implementation of quantum computers, what kinds of problems you can solve on quantum computers. I'll touch on quantum cryptography and post-quantum cryptography, some of the conferences and workshops that you can go to do with post-quantum cryptography, and some information about where the quantum computing investment and research currently is, and a little bit about the future. So this is a brief history of quantum mechanics. In 1900, Max Planck considered the idea that energy is quantized in order to explain the black body radiation effect. And in 1905, Einstein used this idea to explain the photoelectric effect. In 1913, Niels Bohr came up with his model of the atom. And in 1925, Heisenberg came up with his matrix mechanics approach to quantum mechanics. In 1926, Schrödinger developed his wave equation. And then there was a great debate between Einstein and Bohr in the 1927 and 1930 Solvay conferences. Eventually, in 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen wrote the famous EPR paper, where they were not happy with Bohr's description of quantum mechanics, which is a probabilistic approach, and they introduced the idea of a hidden variable theory. And in 1964, Bell introduced an inequality that would test whether hidden variable theory was true or the probabilistic description of quantum mechanics was true. And in 1982, Aspect confirmed Bohr's quantum mechanics versus hidden variable theory. So this is a brief history of quantum computing, which began in 1981 when Richard Feynman had the idea of a universal quantum simulator. And in 1985, David Deutsch extended the ideas of Alan Turing and produced the universal quantum computer and its properties. In 1992, there was the Deutsch-Joser algorithm, which was the first algorithm that provided exponential increase over classical computing algorithm for solving a particular problem. In 1993, Simon produced his algorithm for solving what's called Simon's problem, and Peter Shor based his work, his Shor's algorithm, on Simon's work, and famously produced the factoring and discrete log paper in 1994. In 1996, Grover came up with his quantum search algorithm, which provided basically a square root speed up over classical approaches to finding an element in a list. In 97, Brassard and Hoyer produced extended Grover's algorithm to amplitude amplification. And then in 2002, Childs and other authors produced their ideas to do with quantum random walks. Getting a bit closer to today, in 2009, Harrow, Hasidim, and Lloyd produced a new linear equation solving idea. And I've got a plug there for my PhD thesis. So what I'd like to do is to introduce the idea of behind quantum computing. This comes down to how is a zero or one represented. So physically, this could be to do with like electron spin or the polarization of a photon. And logically, it's represented in Dirac notation. The qubits, 0 and 1, are unit-length vectors denoted by ket 0 and ket 1. And these exist in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, which is a vector space. And so if you have a two-dimensional Hilbert space, ket 0 is a column vector, 1, 0, and ket 1 is a column vector, 0, 1. And these two are form an orthogonal basis for the Hilbert space. And you can generalize that to a 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space where your vectors are 2 to the n long, and you have 2 to the n of them. Now, a superposition is a state where substates exist simultaneously together with corresponding amplitudes. A simplest example of a superposition on a single qubit register is for ket psi here, which is 1 over root 2 ket 0 plus 1 over root 2 ket 1. Here, so this is a single register containing both ket 0 and ket 1 simultaneously. 1 over root 2 is the amplitude of ket 0 and also of ket 1. The amplitudes can be complex numbers, and they have the property that the sum of the squares of the modulus of the amplitudes is 1. So you always end up with a probability distribution. And at the bottom there, I've given sort of a general superposition on n components. So how do states evolve? States evolve by the application of unitary operators, which are matrices, which have the property that they preserve the lengths of the vectors. And all vectors are of length 1. So you're basically taking one vector of length 1 onto another vector of length 1. The operations are reversible, unlike classical computing, and you get a quantum speed up due to the unitary operator acting on each element of the superposition at the same time. So you're not multiplying a factor of 2 to the n when you apply a given unitary operator. And you can get exponential speed up when the unitary operators are sparse. The simplest example of a unitary operator is the Hadamard transform operator here. And when you apply the Hadamard transform to ket 0, you end up with a superposition of 1 over root 2 ket 0 plus ket 1. If you apply the Hadamard transform to ket 1, you end up with the difference between the two ket vectors. So the trick in quantum computing is to find fast unitary operators that can solve problems. Now, once you have a superposition, which is your final state, you make a measurement to obtain a probabilistic answer based on the amplitudes of the state. So the state or wave function collapses down to the answer. So if we consider this simple superposition, we've got an amplitude of root 3 quarters ket 0 plus root quarter ket 1. So 0, when you make a measurement, has a probability of 3 quarters of occurring, and 1 has a probability of a quarter of occurring. So when you make a measurement, you would expect to get ket 0. However, if you're unlucky, you would get ket 1. So when analyzing a quantum algorithm, it's important to know the probability distribution of the final state. So a general quantum algorithm might look like this. You perform some classical algorithm as a prerequisite, and you initialize the state of a quantum register, ket 0, and you apply a series of unitary operators, which are implemented in quantum circuitry in a quantum computer. And then you make a measurement of the final state to obtain an answer to the problem with some probability. And then you perform some follow-on classical algorithm using this information to find the final answer to the problem. example unitary operators are the quantum Fourier transform, which is what Peter Shor used for his factoring and discrete log algorithm, and Grover's quantum search algorithm, which uses a reflection about the average operator. So some other features of quantum computing, there's something called the no cloning theorem, which says it's not possible to make a copy of an unknown quantum state. We already mentioned reversibility, that quantum computations can be reversed. Entanglement is a property of a state whereby it cannot be factored into substates. So here's an example of a Bell state, and that state cannot be factored, and so it's an entangled state. Now, when you have a quantum system in some Hilbert space, it's not in isolation, and it interferes, or it's interfered with by the environment around it in whatever physical system it's represented in. And this is a property called decoherence. And there are quantum error correction codes that are used to protect a quantum system from the effect of decoherence. And here's some of the ones that are listed here. Quantum teleportation is to do with transporting quantum information from one location to another using classical communication channels and previously shared quantum entanglement at the sending and receiving locations. Okay. So in this section, I'd like to briefly mention what are the currently physical implementation methods for potential quantum computers. And there are three possible physical representations that are mainly being investigated at the moment. The first one is to do with trapped ion qubits. And for single gate, these are qubit gates. And here we've listed like the speed of the gate and how accurate the computation of the gate and fidelity of the gate is for representing qubits. Now the interesting number here really is the qubit numbers down at the bottom, where they were able to come up with 7 fully controlled qubits. And down at the bottom there, I've listed some of the research labs that are working in this area. And I've referenced Paul Lopata at the Laboratory for Physical Sciences in College Park, Maryland, where I took some of this information from. Silicon qubits is another area. Going down to the bottom there, the maximum number of qubits is 2, and they had a recent result on October the 5th this year. They had the first 2-qubit silicon logic gate using electron spin. And it looks as though there's only a few labs that are working in this area, including the University of New South Wales in Australia. And then finally, superconducting qubits. They were able to come up with 9 fully controlled qubits so far. This work has been done at the University of Santa Barbara by IBM and University of Chicago. So there's a long way to go at the moment before you'll get the thousands of qubits that you need to implement something like Shor's factoring algorithm, which I'll come to a little bit later. So this is a review of some of the problems that you could solve on quantum computers. And there's a very good website which I'd like to mention, which is the NIST Quantum Zoo, which is maintained by Stephen Jordan at NIST. This website contains a list of references of over 260 papers for solving problems on a quantum computer. And he's basically got a whole list of the different research areas, and he's grouped references, those papers, into the different problem areas. I've al- already mentioned earlier on in the talk some of these problem areas, the factoring of RSA, the discrete log problem that can be applied to ECDH, DSA, and ECDSA, searching. An interesting one is collision finding, which is applicable to like SHA hash functions, for example. And I'll be mentioning that a little bit later. Solving linear equations, which is used in a lot of different places, so that's got big applicability. And on the right-hand side, I've mentioned here which ones provide super polynomial speedup, which is, you could view it as being akin to exponential speedup and polynomial speedup, where you might get, say, a factor of root n speedup. And finally, pattern matching, which was worked on by Ramesh Vinay and Montanaro. Now, another thing that's interesting to do with the searching is that Grover's algorithm assumes that you have a list and you're trying to find one element in the list. However, if you have prior knowledge, that algorithm can be sped up significantly based upon the structure of that prior knowledge. So I was glad to hear in the talks this morning people mentioning the quantum key distribution protocols. This table shows the research that has gone on in this area. First of all, what I'd like to say is the term quantum cryptography really refers to quantum key distribution and quantum random number generation. It doesn't really refer to digital signatures or to, encrypting data. I don't think you're going to be doing encrypting data on a quantum computer. The first QKD protocol was the BB84 protocol, which is probably the best well-known one, where you use a public quantum channel to exchange key information, and the two sides agree upon the key stream, which you could then use perhaps as a secret key in a classical algorithm, or you could use it if you had a high data rate protocol, you could use it perhaps as a one-time pad, for example. I'm not going to go into all of the other research results here. I've listed them really for sort of completeness, as a reference to go back to later on. And this goes on to the other page as well. A lot of them use quantum entanglement or the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and are based on the original BB84 protocol. Now, quantum random number generators, there are two companies that I'm aware of who produce QRNGs, and they're both based upon measurements of photons. The first one is Quintessence Labs, their QStream QRNG, and ID Quantique, they have a Quantis QRNG. And we can compare those RNGs against classical entropy sources. And I'm giving another talk tomorrow to do with, which is like an introduction to entropy estimation. And I'll have some results to do with those QRNGs tomorrow. I've listed here some of the more typical classical entropy sources that you can use as well for comparison. Okay, so post-quantum cryptography. This is a fairly new subject area. Classical cryptographic algorithms are weakened by the existence of quantum computers, and I'll go into in a minute which algorithms are weakened. Post-quantum cryptography is to do with the development of algorithms and protocols that are immune to quantum computer attacks. ETSI, which is the European Telecommunications Standards Institute, used the term quantum safe cryptography, and NSA IAD used the term quantum resistant cryptography. So in this part of the talk, I'll look at the FIPS algorithms that are affected by the existence of quantum computers. I'll briefly touch on the research areas that are being investigated for quantum safe cryptography, and the fact that we need to plan the transition of the security infrastructure to quantum safe cryptography. And a little bit later on, I'll mention which conferences and workshops exist for quantum safe cryptography. A useful reference that I've used here is the ETSI white paper on quantum safe cryptography. It's a really good survey paper. So here are the FIPS 140-2 symmetric key algorithms like AES 128, AES 256, and Triple DES. I provide there a list of what the key lengths are and what the classical computing effective security strengths are for those algorithms. Now, you can use Grover's algorithm to try and break these algorithms and recover the key. And because you're working in a square root algorithm using Grover's search, the effective security strength on a quantum computer is 64 bits, 128 bits, and 84 bits, respectively. So the only one that's really potentially secure is AES 256. For digital signature algorithms, I listed here RSA, DSA, and ECDSA, what the key lengths are, and what the classical computing strengths are. So, as I'm sure you're aware, like 1024 bits has got 80 bits of security, 2048 bits has got 112 bits of security, and 3072 bits has got 128 bits of security. Now, if you have a quantum computer that's large enough that can have sufficiently large number of qubits, then all of these algorithms have got no security strength whatsoever. They can be broken by the algorithms that Peter Shor described in his paper. An interesting question to ask is, well, how many qubits do you need to break these algorithms? Now, for the factoring problem for RSA, you need approximately double the number of qubits compared to the key size. So 1024-bit RSA could be broken using about 2048 qubits, which is a lot of qubits. You know, you're going to have to maintain a superposition that is 2 to the 2048 in size and apply the quantum Fourier transform to it. Similarly for DSA. Now, for elliptic curve cryptography, it's a little bit different. You need about a factor of six times the key size. So, for example, for ECDSA 256, you need 6 times 256 qubits to break ECDSA, which is about, I don't know, 1,500 and something, maybe 36. For the key agreement techniques, Diffie-Hellman and EC Diffie-Hellman are similarly broken using Shor's algorithm, and these would provide no security strength whatsoever with a sufficiently large quantum computer. Obviously, this begs the question, you know, during what time period do we expect to see a quantum computer with this many qubits? But it's definitely something that we need to plan for. Now for hash functions, the SHA, various SHA hash functions, the classical attack is the collision finding attack, which is basically a square root attack. So SHA-1, for example, is a 160-bit digest. Classically, you'd obtain a collision in about 2 to the 80. So similarly on a quantum computer, no one has found an algorithm faster. And it has a similar security strength. So you could view these algorithms, the SHA algorithms, as being quantum safe for SHA-256 or SHA-224 and higher. So these are the basic areas of research for quantum safe cryptography, code-based cryptosystems, lattice-based cryptosystems, hash-based cryptosystems, and multivariate cryptosystems. The only thing that I'm not really familiar with these areas at the moment, that's going to be sort of an area for a future talk, but for lattice-based cryptosystems, GCHQ in England produced, well, it was CESG, I guess, is their sort of defensive side, produced a paper to do with something called Soliloquy, where they described a quantum attack against a lattice-based crypto system that they'd been developing for many years, and they were surprised that they found a quantum attack against it. And they published a paper that you can find on the internet describing what the quantum attack is against this lattice-based crypto system. And that's probably a pretty unusual thing for them to do, to publish that kind of information. But I think they did that in order to point out the difficulties in discovering sort of new crypto systems. So one problem area is, you know, how long is it going to take to find replacements for all of these algorithms that are weak when quantum computers come along? And it's, you know, you look at how long did it take for the AES competition to take, several years, or the SHA-3 competition, for example. There's a lot of theory that has to be developed before you're willing to accept a new algorithm as being secure. You know, at some point we'll have to transition the infrastructure to quantum safe cryptography. We need to research and develop that kind of cryptography in an open and transparent way. We need to transition the infrastructure over to it, developing new algorithms, protocols, and key sizes. We need to think about the impact on vendors, on standards, and the testing labs. And recently, NSA IAD, who previously had been recommending everyone going over to SWETB cryptography, which included elliptic curve cryptography, they put a notice on their website saying that you should stop moving over to SWETB cryptography and wait until quantum safe cryptography comes along. And I think the reason for that I sort of alluded to earlier in the talk, and that is that elliptic curve cryptography is much easier to break on a quantum computer than RSA, for example, because you don't need as many qubits. So, you know, you're more likely to get a quantum computer with fewer qubits to begin with that could break the elliptic curves than for the larger number of qubits that you need for RSA. This is an example list of some of the conferences that have been going on to do with post-quantum cryptography. There was one held, the first one held at NIST in April of this year, and there's a good list of presentations at this website that you can go to. In October of this year, there's the ETSI IQC workshop, and in September, there was the International Conference on Quantum Cryptography. Next year, in February, in Japan, there's the 7th International Conference on Post-Quantum Cryptography. And just recently, there was a workshop on the frontiers of quantum information and computing science held at the University of Maryland. So this slide summarizes quantum computing sort of investment and research. In North America, at the University of Canada, you have sorry, the University of Waterloo in Canada, you have the Institute of Quantum Computing, IQC, which is a sort of center of excellence for quantum computing research and has received over $100 million in private funding since about 2002. You've probably all heard of the D-Wave quantum computer, which this year received some new funding of $25 million. They have a quantum, what they call a quantum computer, which works on over 1,000 qubits, but it solves a specific kind of optimization problem. It is not a general purpose quantum computer where you could run Shor's algorithm on it, for example. But however, Google and NASA have bought a D-Wave, and so has Lockheed Martin. Recently, Intel announced that they've invested $50 million in a 10-year partnership with a Dutch university. Microsoft has got a research facility called Station Q at UCSB, that's Santa Barbara. NIST and the University of Maryland have got a joint quantum institute. And I'm aware of the US Army Research Lab doing research in quantum networks. In Europe, the UK government in 2013 announced that he was going to invest £270 million over 5 years in the area of quantum computing research. And specifically, I think at the end of last year, they announced £120 million was going to go to the creation of certain technology hubs where certain universities would lead the research effort in quantum computing. Also recently, there was someone announced that they would invest $50 million in a company called Cambridge Quantum Computing. And then there are these two other companies which have quantum key distribution and quantum random number generators, ID Quantique and Quintessence Labs. So the future, I'll go out on a limb and predict that the first quantum computer will arrive in 5 years, which is an interesting number because that's what Phil Zimmerman mentioned this morning with respect to fusion. Based upon what I'm seeing and the amount of money and the amount of research effort that's going into this, 5 to 10 years definitely seems doable. It's probably going to cost about $10 million, which is about the same cost as a D-Wave right now. How will it be programmed and who will program it? They've developed a programming language called Quipper, which you can use to sort of estimate the complexity of quantum circuitry that you need to solve particular quantum problems or problems on a quantum computer. Programmers will definitely need to have some kind of knowledge of quantum computing. I think an interesting area of research is what commercial problems can be solved using general purpose quantum computers. What about classical computers and laptops? There's only a subset of problems that can be solved faster on a quantum computer, so we'll still need classical computers for a large set of problem solving or surfing the internet. And as far as quantum safe cryptographic algorithms are concerned, we definitely need to start researching that or putting more effort into researching it. So that's about the end of my talk. This is the list of references, workshops. I've provided a list of some pretty good books here to do with quantum computing, sort of textbooks. Some of the company websites. Some specific papers that I used in putting this talk together. Are any questions?
The quantum safe algorithms, are they known to be provably hard, or is it just the case that we don't yet know of a quantum algorithm to attack them?
quantum safe algorithms, I think it's still a very wide open research area. I mean, I don't think, apart from, I mentioned the SHA algorithms as being potentially quantum safe, but I think in terms of the research areas for the four areas that I listed, I think that's still wide open. I mean, I don't think there's sort of any specific quantum algorithm or quantum safe algorithm that people cannot be broken on a quantum computer. So I think it's still being researched.
And for the SHA algorithms you mentioned, is that known to be unbreakable, or is it just we don't know how to break it?
Well, normally when you analyze sort of like a cryptographic algorithm, you go by what is the best current attack against it. Classically, the best current attack is the collision finding sort of algorithm. And similarly, on a quantum computer, finding collisions cannot be done faster, at the moment at least, than the classical algorithm. So based upon that, just based upon the research for collision finding in the quantum computing arena, they seem to be quantum safe. But you know, somebody might come up with a new algorithm tomorrow, which makes them weak.
Thanks. So you listed the strengths of certain algorithms, AES and RSA and ECC things, and you achieve a halving of the key strength. Why would our response to the threat of quantum computers, which I don't personally believe are going to come in anything like the next 5 years, but in a practical way, but why would our default response be anything other than, well, let's just increase the key size? So 1024 ECC would require 6,144 qubits, and what have we got? 7. I'll take that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. You could continue increasing the key size, but then how long will that algorithm take to run?
A 1024 ECC takes 4 times as long to run in hardware than a 256 ECC.
So you're going to bet your security on the fact that in the next, say, 5 to 10 years, there won't be a 6,000-bit quantum computer coming along. I mean, normally people want to have their security of their data to last for decades.
So I'm coming from the point of view of leading the development of a security protocol for a certain peripheral bus that's near and dear to Intel's heart. And we took a policy decision. We are not seeking to defend against quantum computing attacks because we don't see them as an immediate threat, but took the position that if it is a threat, our migration path can be through increased key sizes. And that seems sufficient, and I'm interested in understanding whether we're making a sane choice or not.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, as I said, you make a very good point. You could do that. But by gradually increasing the key size, the data that you've already encrypted, say, or signed, using weaker key sizes could be broken.
In the future,
you know,
yes.
Once the right. Quantum computers come yeah. along with a relevant number of qubits.
Right. So there's a second kind of related thing to do with key increase, which is with AES, that a nice property of AES 128 and many other block ciphers is the key size is the same as the block size. And for various engineering reasons, having a different key size and block size is a nightmare, and we don't like it. And why the hell doesn't AES have a variable block size that can scale the key size? If it did, it would be easy to increase the key size, but it's not. And that, I assert, is a barrier to defending against quantum computing attacks against AES.
Well,
because of adoption of AES with bigger key sizes is effectively blocked.
So, I think that, you know, if you have AES 256 working on a block size of 256 bits.
Well, it doesn't exist.
It did, not in the standard,
right.
But Rheindahl.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I agree. Yes.
It existed in the original algorithm.
Yes.
But suppose you did have a block size of 256 bits. With a key size of 256 bits, the quantum attack would still be the square root of that.
Yeah, 128, which is good enough.
Yeah, which is good enough. Yeah. So what I'm saying is the block size doesn't matter
many crypto systems are limited by the block size as well as the key size. So yeah. That's
okay, thank you very much.